Our cities have been looking quite different lately. Fewer cars, quieter streets, more joggers and walkers and cyclists, perhaps. I've never seen so many people out with kids on scooters in my neck of the woods. And on a global scale, there have been those eerie images of big cities like New York and London, just vacant and still. We don't know how many of these changes will stick after the COVID-19 restrictions are eased, but can they give us insights into how to design more livable cities? I'd love your thoughts on this. How have the coronavirus restrictions made you think differently about our urban areas? Are there elements that you'd change? Tell us about it on our Facebook page. Melanie Davin is director of the Australian Urban Observatory and co-director of the Healthy Livable Cities Group at RMIT in Melbourne. Melanie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Hilary.
And Claire Martin is a director of the Australian Institute of Landscape Architects. Claire, great to have you here.
Hi, Hilary.
Melanie, you're involved with observing how we use urban spaces in Australia. What have you noticed since the lockdowns around the country?
I think just like you said, like many people, the first thing I really noticed was the quiet and the decreased traffic and decreased congestion, but then how busy our public open spaces are, our local parks.
Yes, there's been a lot of talk about competition between walkers and joggers or walkers and cyclists and dog walkers and things like that. It's a real point of tension, isn't it?
Oh, it definitely is. And the other thing that you're seeing, and you might have heard most recently, I was one of those 100 academics who have signed a letter to say we really need to think about how we can make this permanent so that we can make our cities much more friendly for walking and cycling in the future as well.
Well, when we talk about friendliness, are you seeing a change in the ways we relate to each other within our spaces?
Well, look, I think definitely some things. Recently, we had written a conversation article, started with a conversation between a few of us, and I said, look, we should put this down in writing and put it in the conversation. And some of the main points we really noticed you'd already talked about is just how active, how you've seen people on the street that maybe you've never seen before. And also that, you know, we had these really nice examples where when you walk past people, when you see people a lot, it actually helps encourage those feelings of safety and connectedness to your local area as well. So seeing more people around is great for that. But also the really lovely things like, you know, the chalk on the footpaths where kids have been out entertaining themselves, and also the teddy bear, the bear hunts, where people are really kind of, you know, connecting to the places that they hadn't before.
Claire Martin, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that the lockdown has changed the way we relate to our built areas?
Yeah, I certainly think it has. I mean, I think the most sort of obvious impact immediately is the reduction of cars. And so once you take cars off the road and all those vehicle movements are down, then you are seeing people walking more, you're seeing people cycling more, as you've just discussed. And I think it's just actually reminding people about what's important about connecting with exterior spaces. So being out in nature, the quality of the air is different, the pollution levels are down. So I think it's really reminding people of the importance of being outside. So we have really low levels of, in particular, children spending time outside and growing sort of issues around nature deficit disorder. So I think people reconnecting with their environment and, as you just discussed, reconnecting with each other is really, really critical to affecting sort of long-term behaviour change.
And when you talk about children using spaces, let's hear from Andrea Cook. She's an urban planner and keen dog walker. She lives in inner city Melbourne, and she's seeing some great things emerge in her nearby open spaces.
I have noticed lots more people around and about in the neighbourhood walking and cycling and just kind of being in the parks and enjoying nature. And I've noticed kids out playing, building cubbies. I've noticed cubbies in kind of little pockets of the Yarrabin Park. I think that's a huge benefit to the lockdown, is that there's this revival, I guess, of nature-based play and just enjoying being outside, enjoying quite simple mobilities like walking and cycling. And I think the other thing that I hope that urban planners take from this experience is ideas of equity. And I feel my access to public space is a huge privilege for me that perhaps other people in different parts of the city don't have.
So Andrea lives near a river with a walking track alongside it in inner city Melbourne. Claire, from a landscape architecture point of view, what elements do you think are important from a design perspective to make our public spaces as accessible, as useful and accessible to as wide a range of people as they can possibly be?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question because it's not just about having public open space. It is about the quality and the safety of that space and the accessibility. And so partly that's about the distribution of the public open space. So it needs to be accessible to everyone. So it should be within 20 minutes walk from your home. It should be of, as I said, high quality, should be high amenity and high biodiversity. It really needs to actually work. Public spaces need to work a lot harder because we have high levels of concentration of population in urban areas. So that means that we probably need to consider how generous those public spaces are, how they balance designing for people and not just for people. So that really means encouraging anything for animals, birds, insects. So we've really got to balance how hard our spaces are working. I think it's also about how you actually connect people to those spaces. So we need to have, by slowing streets down and removing cars where possible, widening footpaths, increasing cycling, increasing the urban forest tree canopy so we can actually make our streets cooler and more walkable. So it's really investing in living infrastructure that actually starts to connect a network of green open spaces.
And Melanie, when we think about who has access to those open spaces and who doesn't, what do we see? Is that always a basic matter of privilege?
No, it's quite interesting. So in the Australian Urban Observatory, we have livability indicators across Australia's 21 largest cities. And one of the key indicators that we have in there is access to public open space. Now, these are a spatial view of where is the access and having a look at that down to a neighbourhood level across all of those cities. And when you look at that, even say a result for Melbourne or Sydney, they're not always predictable. So you might find areas that you would think would have good access that don't have close access to public open space. And you might have other areas that people might think, well, they're not going to have good open space and they do have good access. So the issue raised there about equity, I think, is really important. And, you know, some great comments already raised by Claire as well, because we can have a look even in terms of, well, where is the closest park, but what's in that public open space? Because we really do want to provide for multiple benefits here, not just for people to have a local oval that's a space, but whether it has biodiversity features, whether we're providing these public open spaces and designing them differently now so that they're providing for multiple audiences, which includes nature and the creatures that were naturally living there as well. So it's people plus nature plus providing all these multiple benefits in one place.
Russell is very grateful that he lives close to nature, that living infrastructure that you were talking about, Claire. And he says the lockdown has made him think differently about space and access in some really unexpected ways.
I've grown to appreciate my surrounds more because at any point they could be too risky to go into. We are trying to do our part to keep our distance from everyone, but I do have a level of stress or anxiety about people who do come near me. And I guess this has given me a level of understanding and empathy towards women who don't feel safe out in public because they don't know how people out there are going to respond to them as well.
Claire Martin, can you design spaces that are safe for everyone to use? Those beautiful meandering bushy areas that people like to be in, but that can be safe as well?
Yeah, you certainly can. I mean, I think there's always a balance between having areas that are really accessible to people and then areas that are less accessible. But I think what we try and do is design using crime prevention through environmental design techniques. So that's really about territorial reinforcement, about having good sight lines, about managing the height of planting, about ensuring that you have good access for the streets, good activation. So the idea of eyes on the street, the idea that people are with you and connected to you, I think it's just, it's partly, partly a design thing, partly a cultural thing, partly an investment approach as well to the design of our spaces.
Yes, indeed. There are vastly different levels of investment and commitment across Australia, as we've seen in recent years. Melanie, there was some disquiet in Sydney when Waverley Council's mayor said at one point that Bondi and Bronte beaches would reopen, but only for locals. And they said later that that was mainly about common sense. You know, you don't travel during these times, and they never did vote on it. But what does it say about who public spaces are seen to be for in Australia?
Yeah, well, this was interesting, and I did see something on that as well. And I think if you go back to the original, you know, we're sort of talking 18th century principles even of public open space, is it was where people from all different parts of society could come together. So in particularly if you think about England back in those times, it really had that class system that anyone could come together and mix in these places. So they even had that real social equity to them in bringing people together. So in terms of ownership, I think we cannot forget the public in public open space, and public in terms of public good and public health, because we know that they provide both mental health benefits, as you're talking about, and I'm sure audience members would relate to, as well as physical health. So we're using them for different purpose. How we can say to one person, this is not yours or this is mine, I think, you know, going back to those original principles of why they were designed and what the purpose was is really important as well.
When you talk about what's mine and what's not mine, it always makes me think of cars, because so much of the spaces in our cities belong to the cars. Those roads are very hostile places for anyone other than cars. Melanie, is it possible to change that now?
Well, look, in my ideal city, Hillary, I'd like to see walking coming first, cycling next, and the car last. But at the moment, we plan in that opposite hierarchy. And it is, you know, it's what's creating all of these industrial problems, all of these sustainability problems, all of these health problems, because people are needing to sit for so long when they're doing that. But also you've got to think about the broader context of, well, where are we putting the things that people need to access? And if we're going to put them all in the centre of the city and let a city grow wider and wider, sprawl out, of course we're making it more car dependent. We're not thinking about what's the role of public transport in here, and, you know, how can we fit this into the picture rather than the car being the dominant form of transport that we're only really thinking about.
And I guess a lot of people have seen the possibilities of working from home and maybe having a more flexible approach to hours, staggering shifts and things like that. Do you think that could be helpful when it comes to decentralising the car model?
Oh, wouldn't you hope so? You'd hope, wouldn't you hope that people might now go, oh, that thing where people work from home, it's not just this amazing luxury. It's actually something that's really practical in so many other senses. You know, it seems to be pre-COVID, it seems to be that the sort of thing that you were lucky to have. Suddenly when we had to, everybody was supportive. So let's think about how we can do this differently. I'd hate to see that the switch goes back on and we all just do exactly what we did before and we learn nothing from this.
Well, I was interested to hear that Milan is looking at transforming 35 kilometres of roads with new cycle lanes and lower speed limits and wider footpaths. Is that something that you think other cities might do, or are we just really in crisis mode at the moment and we're looking at getting through before we think about a wholesale redesign of our urban areas?
Well, you know, I saw these beautiful images on the news last night of Madrid. I don't know if you've seen, and it had all these cyclists flooding the roads of Madrid because the cars weren't there. And you think, wow, you know, we could do so much more like this. And I know even in my own city of Melbourne that there has been talk within the city of Melbourne of closing down some of our little laneways and turning them into parkland. And you think we just need courageous leadership, people who are going to put themselves right out there and do these amazing things now. And while the cities are quiet, so while we're in this shutdown sort of phase, it's a perfect time to go and change some of these infrastructure too.
Claire Martin, there's often lots of arguments raised about why we can't put more walking or cycling or public transport infrastructure in. Do you think some of the barriers to those changes might lessen after people see what it could be like with fewer cars?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I mean, I think what this is doing is really sort of capturing the public imagination. So it's reminding them of what's really important, perhaps how they used to move around the city in a slower way, perhaps when there was sort of less density. So I think it is definitely a reminder for everyone. And I think there are really good examples. I've certainly worked on a project which has converted two-thirds of a street, removed parking and one lane of traffic, and is introducing a whole new public park, the first park in Melbourne for nearly 20 or 30 years. So I think there's definitely initiatives for doing that. And I think what we really need to do is build on the goodwill that's out there at the moment. So we have a national cabinet, and that national cabinet is really engaging in good public engagement. They're having difficult conversations with people about things that we might need to give up or changes of investment strategies. And I think that's what we've really got to start to do, is start to consider that if we invest in living infrastructure versus single use infrastructure. And what I mean by that is, you know, regenerative infrastructure that is actually going to lead to tangible change in terms of the cooling of our cities, the connectivity of our cities, the health of our citizens. I think that's the sort of the difficult conversation can be brought forward when the government is already, you know, invested in a very significant and very successful public engagement campaign.
It's interesting to see people really enjoying the less densely populated streets, but in reality, that's not the reality of our urban areas, is it? I mean, we have increasing density in our cities. That's not going away. Our population grows the economy, and there's a fairly broad national shift towards greater density in our urban areas. Claire Martin, can you maintain or increase access to parks in that situation? I mean, can you retrofit open space, as you say, has been done in Melbourne, on a broader national scale?
Yeah, I think you definitely can. Certainly there's initiatives across the country of the buyback of land by governments in order to turn different types of whether brownfield or greenfield or many brownfield sites into public open space. So I think it's also about trying to leverage private investment. So what we're talking about is having equitable access to public open space, but it's also about working with private organisations who can actually create spaces that connect links between public open space that also provide amenity and access. So I think it's probably about looking at different models of investment. I think in terms of planning, we already know, I think we're all pretty aligned in terms of knowing that we need multi-centered cities. So the planning of new cities can shift to that walkable aspect. And then what we need to do is retrofit our current cities. And so that really does mean that you might have to extend footpaths, that you try and create good soil volumes, that you work with the different service authorities to ensure that you can actually deliver, you know, all of the different utilities that we need in our streets, as well as good soils, and actually investing in infrastructure that acts almost like a sponge. So we can actually take some of the avoidance cost and invest that into new infrastructure.
So
minimising flooding.
Ah, yes. Let's bring it back to the neighbourhood level for a moment. Sarah lives in the verdant Dandenong Ranges near Melbourne. She's been doing a lot of gardening in recent weeks, and it's given her some ideas about the future.
We're very lucky here that we do have backyards, but they're sloped and they're quite shaded. So it would be great if town planners could find some more ways for communities to do vegetable gardening together. I know our council does allow us to plant on our nature strip, but Indigenous plants only. So it would be, and I know there's a council somewhere that lets, that actually comes and assists and removes the grass for you and brings in some topsoil. Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Melanie Davin, would that be a step towards greater livability on a local level?
Oh, definitely. I think so. You know, you have to, it's always a balance in keeping all of community happy. And I'm sure many local governments would understand that. But at the same time, you think about in terms of understanding what a livable place looks like, it has to be attractive. It has to be sustainable. So if we had areas, like you think about a nature strip in an area, it sits there, it's generally unused, it's not productive. You have these real kind kind of conflict often between, is that mine or is that the council's? The same with the street trees. But if you could have people really adopt that local area in front of their house and bring people together, you often see people in different areas and they're actually kind of, they'll talk because someone's out there and they're gardening, someone walks past. So it's even community building in that way as well.
That's a lovely idea for the future. Melanie, Claire, thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters today to chat about this.
Thanks, Hilary.
Pleasure, Hilary. Thank you.
Melanie Davins, Director of the Australian Urban Observatory and Co-Director of the Healthy Livable Cities Group at RMIT, and Claire Martins, Associate Director with Oculus Landscape Architecture and a Director of the Australian Institute of Landscape Architects.